Support for programming on NET Radio comes from Mari Sando Society, presenting Walter Echohawk, Native American speaker, author, and attorney, Thursday, September 28th at 7:30 p.m. at the Chatham State College Student Center. The Sando Symposium follows on Friday and Saturday. Details and registration at marisandos.org. Union Bank, celebrating 100 years of helping families and businesses in Nebraska and looking forward to the next 100, offering customers personal and business banking, as well as wealth management services. Union Bank, member FDIC. And SMG Lincoln, presenting Wilco with its blend of American rock, appearing at Pinewood Bowl Theater in Lincoln on Friday, September 22nd. For tickets, Ticketmaster.com.
Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Genevieve Randall. A diverse and exciting show this morning with some Welsh history of Nebraska, chamber music in Lincoln, an oral history workshop and speakers in Hastings, and more celebrations of the sesquicentennial in artwork, song, and literature. I'd invite you to stay with us for all of that and more, and to try out watching the show. We stream video live each week on netnebraska.org. Just click on the link that says live and on demand. My first guest teaches at Trinity University in San Antonio, has essays that have appeared in many publications, including Salon, Plowshares, and New England Review. She's an alum of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and former Lincolnite. Back in town for a reading and book signing at Indigo Bridge in Lincoln tonight at 7 p.m., she has just released her debut memoir titled We Are All Shipwrecks. And I should mention, because it'll probably be clear as we're talking, that we know each other. So we'll just get that part out of the way. Kelly Gray Carlisle, so great to have you on Friday Live.
It's so glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me. This was like when I was a lowly grad student writing at the mill. This was one of my dreams to get to be on live Friday Live.
So here you are. So I'm going to catch listeners' attention right off the bat here by reading the first three sentences of the description of your book from your website. And this is just, I know it's an attention getter, and you know. So one night in 1976, my mother, Michelle, left me in a motel room in Hollywood. I was 3 weeks old. Her strangled body was found on a hillside the next morning. So how old were you when you found out what happened to your mother?
So my mother died when I was 3 weeks old. As that little intro says, she left me in a dresser drawer in a motel room in Hollywood and went out to try to earn some money to keep that humble roof over our head. But I didn't know that growing up for quite a while. And when I was 8 years old, my grandfather took me to have brunch with the detective who had worked on her case. And her case was ultimately unsolved. And so right before that brunch, he let me know that my mother had actually been murdered and not died in a car accident, which is what I had always thought. And so that's where my book begins, is with that brunch with the detective and sort of wanting to ask him all these questions about my mother, whom I never really, I mean, obviously never knew. And my grandfather never really knew her either. So I actually had very little to go on. And so it begins with that lunch and wanting to ask all these questions. And then that's sort of the course of the book, is ultimately getting to find the answers to a lot of those questions I had about my mom and her death.
Well, and I think a lot of us have this sort of self-discovery, no matter what our stories are. But in particular, this is a very unique story. When did you know that your story was as unique or as different as it was?
Well, I always knew that I had a weird childhood, that death of my mother was actually the beginning of the weirdness. I would have had a normal life with my grandfather who raised me, except one of the things he did for a living was he had an adult video store by LAX. My story is set in Los Angeles. And so it was like any small business. We had a lot of the stuff around in our house. And so there was a lot of porn in my house. And then when I was in sixth grade, my grandfather, who was also obsessed with boats, moved us on board this boat in the LA Harbor. So my childhood was weird, and I always knew that. But I didn't know it was really worth writing about until I was at grad school at UNL. And one of the things you do when you're in writing grad school for writing is you go to bars with other writers. And so I would tell these stories and they'd be like, you know, because I was a fiction writer at the time, they were like, you should maybe write that story. And I was like, no. But they were right. It really was a big story I needed to tell. And once I started working on it, I realized it was a much bigger story than maybe an essay or two.
Sure. You know, as a Flatlander, it really was fascinating for me to read about the marina that you lived in for a good part of your childhood. And this particular marina was run down. You describe it very well. Yet, there were these things like someone taught you to garden. Could you talk about those contrasts a little bit?
Sure. So we lived at the back end of the Los Angeles Harbor, which I believe is the second busiest port in the world. So it was very industrial, a lot of big ships, a lot of pollution. Everything was very dirty. The water was dirty. There was a gas sheen on it almost all the time. There is like black sort of slime over everything on our boat. And so I was breathing all that. And the people who lived in our marina were very poor because it was one of the places in LA you could have really cheap rent and you could afford to live there. So a lot of them were on welfare or disability. And they saw that I was having this strange childhood, maybe a little hard in my family. And they sort of took me under their wing. And so Annie, who's one of the bigger characters in my book, she was, you know, very poor. Her husband was a truck driver, but, you know, they weren't rich by any stretch of the imagination. And she decided that I needed to help her in her garden that she was building in the parking lot of the marina in this really horrible soil that used to be like muck on the bottom of the harbor that had been dredged up. And she did. She amended the soil. She taught me how to garden. And I've always loved gardening. And so once I moved to Nebraska, where the soil is amazing, right, I had a garden in grad school a lot of the time. And it was because of her. And so a stranger who just did something nice for a child actually changed that child's life. And that's a big theme in my book, is how strangers can rally around children and help them grow, even if they have a really difficult home life.
I have a kind of an interesting question, because another big character in your life, of course, is your grandfather, mm-hmm. who primarily raised you. Was your grandfather a good person?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer. He was very complicated, and so he did amazing acts of generosity to people who worked for him. He took me in and raised me. He could be very, very kind. He could be very charming. But he also did things, like I learned through the course of writing this book, that he was not involved at all with, really, with my mother's upbringing, only tangentially, so he kind of abandoned his daughter. And he was not very nice to my step-grandmother, his wife, who was basically my mother figure growing up. And, you know, he was verbally abusive of her and, you know, really didn't help her have a good life. And so he was very complicated, but the one sort of redemption of my story is, you know, he didn't do a good job with his own daughter, but when he had a chance to raise me, he raised me well and did his best that he could and was loving ultimately of me. And so in that way, I'd say he found his way to being a good person, maybe, is a way of saying it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that brings me to that. Your book seems like it's about so many things. It's a memoir for you. It tells your story. It's also about second chances. Those ideas about nature versus nurture come up in this book. DNA versus, you know, what just happens to us in our experiences, or like Annie influencing your love of gardening. What do you think about how your life might have been in different circumstances? How much do you think that weighs in your life?
I think, you know, it's really funny. I spent so much of my childhood and adolescence wanting to escape my home. And I don't mean it was horrible. I just wanted to live somewhere else. I didn't want to live in Los Angeles. I wanted to live in places like Nebraska, say. And what I've realized is as difficult and just really profoundly weird that my childhood was, I wouldn't have been a writer without it. I wouldn't have been a writer without my grandfather, the consummate lying storyteller. I wouldn't have been the writer without my step-grandmother to show me details and help me to notice things about nature and about the world around me. And I probably wouldn't have been a writer if I hadn't had a lot of stories to tell from my childhood. And so, like, obviously, I wouldn't be who I was if I hadn't had that childhood. And it sounds really arrogant. I kind of like who I am right now. And so I'm, in a way, I guess I'm very grateful that I had that weird childhood, although I do try and create a very normal childhood for my own children and a stable one. So,
yeah.
One on land.
Well, I think you're a wonderful person, but I'm a little biased.
Thank you.
And it's, the author is Kelly Gray Carlisle. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Kelly.
You too.
The book is We Are All Shipwrecks. It came out September 5th, and Kelly will be appearing at Indigo Bridge Books tonight for a reading and book signing at 7 p.m. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me, Genevieve.
Still ahead on Friday Live, the Nebraska by Heart Project and its culmination in October. I'll also have highlights from our arts calendar. This is NET Radio and netnebraska.org. And lectures in Hastings will be hosted by Hastings Oral History Initiative. That's on Sunday, September 17th, as well as coming up October 8th. The events this Sunday are from 3 to 5 p.m., held at the Lark in downtown Hastings, following the theme Oral History and Local History. Joining me to explain more is Dr. Michelle Marino, history professor at Hastings College, who worked with students on launching the Hastings Oral History Initiative. It's nice to have you on Friday Live this morning.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for talking with me.
Well, so tell me more about this initiative and how it got started in the first place.
Well, it really got started, or was rather born out of my own personal frustrations, where I would start these oral history projects with students, and then nothing really ever happened with the interviews, and they sort of collected dust in my file cabinet in my office, despite all good intentions to, you know, donate them to local libraries or historical societies. And so I came up with the idea that the next time I did a student-led oral history project, that we would create a digital online archive as a way to sort of bring oral history to the public and make interviews more accessible. And so when I taught my Intro to Oral History Methods class last fall, I had the students sort of help me frame out the project and help create the online archive as a way for students to get engaged in oral history, but also to create an initiative that was reaching out to the public and also making sort of an accessible space for anyone in the community to donate their interviews that they had done for safekeeping, but also to make them publicly accessible.
So for this first community workshop on Sunday, there's also going to be two short lectures as part of it. Who are the lecturers and what are their topics?
The first speaker is Elizabeth Spilenick, and she is with the Adams County Historical Society, and her talk is titled Local Voices from the Past, and she is sort of presenting some of the collections or oral history collections that the Historical Society has, specifically related to the Kipp Cigar Company that was here in Hastings. And so she's going to sort of talk about the importance of oral history and oral history practice to creating local history as well. Mm-hmm. So that's what she'll be focusing on. And our second speaker is Amy Pierce, and she is the owner of the business Stories in Time. And she categorizes herself as a personal historian, and so she practices oral history, but specifically family history as well, and about the importance of gathering your own personal histories and family histories, and her business helps families do that, and then she often creates books that families can purchase that sort of tells the history of their own families, and so she's going to be talking a little bit more about personal history and also how that ties into local history too. And her title is Saving Lives, One Story at a Time.
You know, when learning histories of different kinds, I'm wondering what's important about learning personal histories or personal stories like that, as opposed to just, you know, histories of things like businesses or political or economic landmarks, inventions, and so on.
And that's what I think is so important actually about oral history, is that this is a great avenue to actually capture personal histories and show people that their stories matter, that it's actually not just top-down, that it's not just politicians, it's not just businesses in the community, that people are actually at the heart of the community, mm-hmm. and their stories are important and actually help create local history, too. So I think oral history is a really great avenue to approach that. and also an accessible way to practice history, that, you know, you don't have to necessarily have all this extensive training or writing skills or anything, but what you do need is to be able to sit down and listen to someone tell their stories. And so it's a really great way to engage the public and get them involved in creating their own community histories too.
Now, the second workshop is October 8th. That will be from 2 to 4 p.m. at Prairie Loft in Hastings. And that addresses the theme, the LGBTQIA community and oral history. So who are the speakers for that workshop?
We're bringing in a woman by the name of J.J. Kale, and she teaches Spanish at the Blake School, which is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She will be speaking specifically on this idea of sort of absent narratives and the importance of oral history to marginalized communities, particularly the LGBTQIA community. J.J. grew up on a farm outside of Kearney, Nebraska, and sort of struggled as a queer youth of fitting in and telling her story. And so she'll be speaking about her own experiences, but then also why it is important for the LGBTQIA community to share their stories, in part to also make sure that they understand that their stories are a key part to the history of the community. Their voices matter, and they have important things to tell us about their community history.
I've been talking here with Michelle Marino. She is a Hastings College history professor and a founder, along with students there, of the Hastings Oral History Initiative. Two events are planned with workshops and with speakers. One of those is September 17th at 3 p.m. at the Lark, and the next one is October 8th at Prairie Loft. Thanks so much for telling us about these events.
Thank you so much for having me and helping spread the word. I appreciate it.
Informing and inspiring Nebraska with unique programming, this is NET Radio. Born of British and American parents, Louisa was of Europe, not New England, like her husband, John Quincy Adams. Her life and marriage to Adams was difficult, but her voice comes through strongly in a new biography called Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams by Louisa Thomas.
One of the ways in which biographer Thomas thoroughly succeeds is her drawing a picture of Louisa that is not entirely overpowered by the large figure of John Quincy in the background. One of the reasons for this is the amount of Louisa's own writing. She wrote often to many correspondents, and fortunately her letters were saved from this time, so Thomas could quote substantially from Louisa Adams' own words.
Hear a full review of the biography, Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams, on this week's All About Books. It's available on our website, along with past reviews. Go to netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks. Among the myriad of projects and events celebrating Nebraska's sesquicentennial, one of the most visual in our state's capital city has been Nebraska by Heart. Heart sculptures that have been seen all over the city, contributed by all kinds of different artists. And beginning October 2nd, however, those hearts will be picked up and taken to Haymarket Park for an event on Thursday, October 5th. And on October 6th. And Liz Shea McCoy is here to talk more about it. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
So good to see you.
So good to see you.
So this public art project has been up for some time this year. Give listeners just a reminder of what these sculptures look like and where the artists are from who contributed.
The sculptures are 6-foot hearts, mostly fiberglass. We have 89 now. Within the last few weeks, we had 6 additional hearts created. 3 are Husker hearts on the east side of Memorial Stadium. 2, one is a multicultural heart, a futuristic heart, both in front of the main post office in the Haymarket. And then we have a heart dedicated in honor of Clayton Anderson, Nebraska's first and only NASA astronaut. So, for the most part, these hearts are made out of fiberglass. They have a Nebraska-shaped base, mm-hmm. which really is a symbol of the love and pride that we have of our great state of Nebraska. And what an amazing way to celebrate all that we have right here in our great state.
Now, I mentioned that the hearts are going to be rounded up here for the October 5th event. What are the logistics of that? How much do they weigh? And where all, this is a lot of miles someone has to cover.
The hearts vary in weight from, I would say, about 150 pounds to over 1,000 pounds. And that really just depends on what the artist put on their heart, whether they just painted their heart or added mosaics or additional three-dimensional features. So they vary in weight. It is a Herculean task to take them out and place them around the concourse of Haymarket Park, which is the baseball stadium, not to be confused with our historic Haymarket.
Right.
So October 5th, from 11:30 until 8, Haymarket Park will be open. It's our public preview. It's a free, family-friendly event. Mm-hmm. All are invited to see all 89 hearts that will be displayed around the concourse. Many of the artists will be present to talk about their design process, sign a copy of the book that we will have for sale. The books, we have really a limited edition of Nebraska by Heart books that show all 89 hearts and include the artist's inspiration statements. So I think this is a chance for those who have seen the hearts or who have not to see them all in one venue.
It should be amazing to see all of those in one place.
Exactly.
I mean, 89 is quite a bit.
Well, it is. And, you know, to meet these artists, these incredible artists, mm-hmm. representing 24 Nebraska counties, from Omaha all the way across the state to Scotts Bluff, you know, we offer a project, but it's the artists. And I have to say also our patrons that sponsored these artists, the artists' mentors, because we needed both to make this a success. And Nebraska by Heart has certainly become a success that Nebraskans and all visitors to our state have loved and embraced.
And then after that October 5th event, the next day is the auction, Friday evening. What happens with the hearts after the auction?
Well, can we talk a minute about the auction? Oh, my gosh. Gates open to Haymarket Park at 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, it's a preview to see all the hearts before the auction begins. Again, the artists, many of them will be present. The auction starts at 7 o'clock. It will go fast and furious until all the hearts have been auctioned to the highest bidder. Something very important for those that would love to bid on a heart but cannot be present, we do have proxies available. And you need to contact me, Liz Shea McCoy. I'm the director of the project. And 402-430-5923 or liz_shea@windstreams.net. I'm really dedicated to this project, and many of the people that would love to have a heart, you know, whether it's in front of the county seat, a school, in a park, your business, these are proud mementos of our state sesquicentennial, a very, you know, something we all are proud of.
Yeah, I would say. And we'll make sure that we have a link on the Friday Live page as well,
so people
can link through to the website if they want more information there. I've been talking here with Liz Shea McCoy about Nebraska by Heart, the public art project celebrating Nebraska's 150th anniversary of statehood, and that will culminate in that public event on Thursday, October 5th from 11:30 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then the auction the next day. Doors open at 5, auction starts at 7.
A question that it's often asked, where do the proceeds of the auction go?
Oh, sure, yeah.
There's two sponsoring organizations, very worthy, Sadie Dog Fund, who raises funds to support families who cannot afford the very expensive surgeries for their animals, And the second is Lead Up, which encourages at-risk youth with that are very, very capable to graduate from college and find a career that they love. The third part of the money will go to the artist. So one-third, 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 and we're very excited to put this one forward and see what happens.
All right. Well, Liz, wonderful talking with you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A celebration of Nebraska in song, two absolute stars of Broadway, and some Welsh history in Nebraska. Those topics and much more still to come here on Friday Live on NET Radio and netnebraska.org.
Support for programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska, presenting the Governor's Lecture in the Humanities on October 3rd, featuring author T.J. Stiles. For details on this Nebraska 150 event, humanitiesnebraska.org.
Be sure to check out the arts calendar on our website, both to make plans and to add your event. The address is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here are some highlights. The International Quilt Study Center and Museum in Lincoln is currently hosting an exhibition of work by Brian Haggard. Vintage Visions is on view through October 4th. The Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts in Nebraska City is hosting Esprit Decor Photography by Walker Pickering now through October 20th. An artist talk will be held there October 19th. And Trinity Episcopal Cathedral Choir from Omaha will present choral works by Nebraska composers in a choral evensong in North Platte at Episcopal Church of Our Savior. That's tomorrow at 5 p.m. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio. With year-long celebrations of Nebraska's sesquicentennial, a series in Omaha will celebrate with song this Sunday at Gallery 1516, part of the Bagels and Sometimes Bach Sunday concert series. We'll hear Opera Vox, which is just the third Sundays of that series, from Opera Omaha, hosting Celebrating Nebraska in Song, and that's at 11:30 a.m., featuring a number of guests, including my next guest, Hal France, longtime artistic director for Opera Omaha, among other hats that he wears. And in this case, he'll also be playing piano. Hal France, it's such a pleasure having you back on Friday Live.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
First of all, who are the other musicians performing on this Celebrating Nebraska in Song event?
I'm joined by a Lincoln favorite, Jesse Waldman, who graduated from UNL, I think last year, sang many roles with UNL Opera. Jesse will be singing some art songs and also folk songs, which gets me to Jill Anderson, longtime and very, very, very talented member of our Nebraska community, especially known for her folk interests. And she's going to be singing some folk stuff with us. And also cellist David Downing, who's an outstanding composer and cellist, who's going to be playing one of his own pieces and then joining us for some of the favorites that we're going to offer on this concert.
Now, the venue there, as I mentioned, is Gallery 1516 in Omaha. How is it making music surrounded by artwork?
Well, the artwork specifically relate to this program, and it's really inspired it. It's the legacy of Nebraska paintings of Todd Williams, commissioned by the Nebraska 150 for the sesquicentennial. 93 paintings, 93 Nebraska counties, and I looked at those paintings and tried to make connections with the program that we put together. So it's especially going to be great because it's site-specific, as it were, and I'll make remarks and be trying to say what it was about certain paintings that inspired us to choose some of the music. So it's going to be fun.
Well, yeah, sounds like what an amazing way to make a connection both with the music and then with Todd Williams' paintings as well. I noticed with those connections, there's some Nebraska poets featured. Tell me a little bit more about the repertoire and what other Nebraskans are connected with this.
When I knew this was going to happen during the exhibit, I started digging and was happy to find the settings of some Ted Kooser poems, Flying at Night, by the great American composer Stephen Paulus, which was originally written for Thomas Hampson. Well, Jesse was going to do it, so that was a natural. And these are beautiful poems. We're doing three of the five songs that he set. And then we are doing a segment from something that's been in Lincoln and also been at in Red Cloud, part of the Cather Festival. The novel Lucy Gayheart is one of the many Cather novels that is a musical focused, and this one particularly features a reading of excerpts by Jill Anderson with music, which in the novel is Schubert Lieder. So we'll be doing a couple of Schubert songs in connection with the Cather. That was one of the fun things that we were able to come up with.
I also see a recent commission, which was in collaboration with the Hildegard Center for the Arts, is included with excerpts from work by Jared and Pachachaha Tate. And Omaha seems like a particularly fitting location to perform this work, which was about Standing Bear.
I'm really thrilled that Hildegard let us offer this excerpts of this exciting new work, which premiered at the Lead Center in the Johnny Carson Theater last November. It hasn't yet been heard in Omaha, and this is just a preview, I hope, of a premiere, a full performance of it with the Rangbrook and Jared and everyone else that will come at some point in the future. So I'm kind of being a little Pied Piper and trying to get the ball rolling. I think it's a great new work, and it focuses on really one of the, I think, greatest Nebraskans, Chief Standing Bear, and the legacy. And it is one of the 93 paintings of Todd Williams, who's for Dixon County, is the portrait of Standing Bear. So it certainly was appropriate for the purposes of this.
Now, I mentioned that this is part of a series and that Opera Vox is the third Sunday of that series. Do you want to talk about what's coming up ahead on the series?
I'm allowed to go one Sunday further. I can tell you we have October 15th will feature my co-host, Sean Kelly, representing a program that includes the new resident artists of Opera Omaha. I don't know what this program is yet, but it'll be at 11:30 on October 15th. And then we will be doing another one in November, which I think I have to hold back. But there's two very exciting artists on that and another program that I'm really excited about.
And that next performance on that Sunday series, Bagels and Sometimes Bach, is an Opera Vox performance titled Celebrating Nebraska in Song. That's at 11:30 a.m. this Sunday at Gallery 1516 in Omaha. I've been talking with Hal France about that event. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And you can link to more information about this and all the events you hear about on Friday Live by going to our website at netnebraska.org/radio. Just click on the icon for Friday Live. Again, that's netnebraska.org/radio. Two writers have created a book celebrating the history of agriculture in the last 150 years in Nebraska. Their cover art is that of nationally renowned Ashland, Nebraska artist Gene Ronka, whose gallery writer Jody Lamp discovered by serendipity.
My family and I were looking for a potential place to move back to Nebraska, and we just discovered the small town of Ashland outside of Lincoln and decided that we would take a peek in their historic downtown area and just happened to park near the gallery and went in. Long story short, it's like we've never left. We just fell in love with the gallery and Gene Ronka's work.
Jody L. Lamp and Melody Dobson talk about Gene Ronka's art, how personal stories are part of history, and their book, A History of Nebraska Agriculture, A Life Worth Living, in this week's Friday Live Extra. You can listen to that online or download as a podcast at netnebraska.org/radio. You're listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio, coming to you this week from the historic Haymarket District in Lincoln at the Mill Coffee and Tea. And just a few blocks from here is the Lead Center for Performing Arts, which has been hosting my next guests and many others during the Grow a Show workshop. There were master classes, staging of new work, along with coaching and other feedback. Stephen Bray is a songwriter, producer, who won a 2016 Tony Award for Best Musical Revival for The Color Purple. And Jason Michael Webb is a composer, musician, and conductor who was musical director for The Color Purple on Broadway. He is also a keyboardist, and he arranged Battle Hymn of the Republic for the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Stephen Bray and Jason Michael Webb, welcome to Friday Live.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming here this morning. It's just amazing. And Bill Steffen, executive director for The Lead, also here. Welcome, Bill.
Good to be here.
Good to see you again. So let's talk first about The Color Purple. It's coming to the Lead Center, but not until April, based on Alice Walker's book and Steven Spielberg's film. How did writing the musical start?
It started because a man named Scott Sanders, who we love dearly, had the courage to say, let's find some writers who haven't done Broadway before and have them adapt the show. And it was obviously daunting because that's such an iconic novel, such a beautiful story, and had been incredibly aptly filmed by Steven Spielberg. And so we set about the task of trying to bring as much novel as we could to the stage so that we weren't in competition with that film.
So this makes you perfect for the Grow a Show workshop. I mean, you know what some of these new writers and new creators are going through.
Absolutely. And we're all going through it. You know, every time you start one, you basically are resetting, and because no one knows anything at the beginning. And you discover, and they say that you don't write musicals, you rewrite them. So
I gotcha.
It's a great process.
And Jason, how did you get involved in the production of The Color Purple?
Well, I was hired to be the musical director. I was MDing Marley, a production of Marley down in Baltimore. Got the call to come up and have a meeting, and booked the gig. Stephen said yes, so I said, okay, I'll stay.
And why wouldn't you, right? I'm sure that we could talk probably for most of the show about The Color Purple, but I know we'll learn even more from Bill here in just a second, and we'll learn more in April probably too when the show comes to the Lead. I'd like to learn just a little bit about your experiences this week, though, working with Grow a Show. What kind of things did you see? What do you want to share with us?
Well, what really struck me and what makes my heart happy is working with the young people and just seeing the... I know what it felt like to be young and have dreams, and I knew what I wanted to do with my life, and just to see that in their eyes and to be a part of giving back what was given to me when I was younger, that's what really makes me happy.
How about for you?
Well, I would certainly ditto that, and the process of watching a writer at the beginning of it and being part of, you know, it's very exciting to say, you know, have you thought about this character maybe doing this or that, you know, in a different way? That, because I was talking to some of the Grow a Show folks, the Grower, what's the club, Bill?
Growers Club.
The Growers Club. I was talking to some of the members, and I was telling them that it's just without a program like this here, where you have the ability to create you have a venue of complete, you know, top-notch, first-level quality producers and actors. Your talent community here is fantastic. Without that, we writers have no clue what we're doing, because we're sitting in a room going, well, I think this is a story, but until you can put that in front of on its feet, so to speak, even in a staged reading, and hear a room respond to it. So it's been really magical to, you know, be part of that, and I can't wait to come back.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm sure we'd be happy to have you back.
That was my
for
plug.
Sure. Yeah, right? So just a few more fun facts here for listeners about the two of you. Jason Michael Webb, you have played with artists such as Jennifer Hudson, Michael Bolton, Chaka Khan. Stephen Bray, you wrote and produced music for Breakfast Club, wrote and produced 12 Billboard Top 10 recordings, including Papa Don't Preach, True Blue, and Express Yourself. Let's go back to those beginnings, very, very beginnings. What were the very beginnings of each of your musical careers? When were you first exposed to music?
I began playing at 4 years old. I'm classical, so my entire training is classical. But at the same time, I worked for the church for a very long time, so I had a very gospel training. And then at the same time, I loved top 40 pop radio. And so all those things together kind of inspired me to want to create those things, because I knew what they did for me.
Yeah. How about you, Steven?
And I'm a complete church choir nerd. from pretty much day one. My mom, both my parents sang in the church choir, and so I was there in rehearsals from probably age three. In fact, my mom said she missed church the day I was born. So. And so that kind of exposure to harmony, you know, and choral singing, just, you know, I'm still in love with it. But that's how it started.
All right. Now, Bill, since we have you here, would you like to talk about upcoming shows at the Lead Center?
Well, I just, you know, we're so excited about having the national tour of The Color Purple. And it was so inspirational seeing all the music with the Nebraska talent on our stage. And, you know, and the musical's coming April 11th through the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And our biggest Broadway show of the year. And we do have the B-52s kicking off our season here in a couple weeks on September 30th. And Trevor Noah's almost sold out, as well as the national tour of Motown, which is its first visit to Lincoln. So we're excited about all those great Motown hits, and it's going to be a great year.
Sounds good, and I'm sure you and I will be talking to each other much more throughout the year.
Yes, absolutely.
Bill Steffen, Executive Director for the Lead Center for Performing Arts. Always glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I've also been talking here this morning with Stephen Bray and Jason Michael Webb. They've been in Lincoln this week working with actors and musicians during Grow a Show, new musical theater workshop. Stephen Bray co-wrote the music for The Color Purple, and Jason Michael Webb was musical director for the Broadway production. That show, again, will be in Lincoln in April at the Lead Center. Thank you both for being part of Friday Live this
morning.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Heard a question you liked, but then spaced out during my guest's answer? Take a second listen to Friday Live. No problem. We podcast the show each week. You can look for that later this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. That address, netnebraska.org/radio. Stay with Friday Live. We'll hear a preview of the Vesper Concert Series coming up and talk with musicians from Nebraska Chamber Players about their next concert. This Sunday, a contemporary Welsh forum will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Lincoln. Dr. Berwyn Jones will talk about Welsh settlers who came to Nebraska. Jones and Lincoln Arts Council's Laurie McAllister are both here now to give us a preview of the forum. Good morning, Laurie and Berwyn.
Good morning.
Ba-da-da.
There you go. I was hoping that we would get some phrases this morning. Well, let's start with why people from Wales came to America.
Well, they came to America largely to get away from a situation that kept them in poverty. They paid taxes to the established church, and they didn't belong to it, because the pulpits were occupied by placeholders. They were nonconformists. They were Calvinistic Methodists, and they were Baptists, and they were Congregationalists, and they were not Anglicans.
And was Nebraska...
And they couldn't...
Huh? Was Nebraska particularly popular for Welsh settlers?
Nebraska was sort of the end of a train of immigration that started in New York and Vermont, where there were slate quarries, and in Pennsylvania, where there was coal and steel and railroads. And coming across Ohio for farmland, for some reason they kind of skipped over Indiana and then into Illinois, Well, Indiana wasn't the greatest farmland. Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and finally Nebraska, and then they discovered that when they got to western Nebraska, the land would not support traditional agriculture.
Right.
So that was the end of the line for the land grab.
So which communities in Nebraska have the most people of Welsh ancestry?
Well, Wymore, which is the site of the Welsh Heritage Center, where I got most of my material. We have the archive for Welsh America there. It's a tornado-proof building that we added on to our museum building. And it contains archives of Welsh settlements all over the country, really from New York to Los Angeles. What was the question?
Oh, yeah, sure, no. It was just about communities in Nebraska that have Welsh ancestry.
Oh, sure, but that's and then in Wayne well. County, at Carroll, there was a settlement that was actually big enough that there were two separate Welsh chapels. One was Calvinistic Methodist, which is really Presbyterian, and a congregational church. About a mile and a half apart.
It does seem like that would be quite the settlement then if they can support two separate churches.
Yeah. Well, there's an old Welsh joke about the shipwrecked Welsh sailor. And when he was rescued, he showed his rescuers around what he had built on the island and showed them his chapel. And then the rescuer asked, "Well, what's that other building up there?" "Oh, that's the chapel I used to go to." Wales is famous for schisms.
I see. Now, the Welsh language is very interesting and beautiful to hear. I'm wondering if the two of you could give us a couple more phrases or words and tell us what they mean.
Well,
I know I've put you on the spot. I should have prepped you, right?
Berwyn Jones, dwi. I am Berwyn Jones.
He's thinking.
Indod or Nebraska. And Buin, Nebraska. I was born in Nebraska, and I live in Nebraska.
Very nice. I like that. That's good. Lori, was there anything you wanted to add about the forum?
Well, this is our fourth Contemporary Welsh Forum on behalf of the St. David's Welsh Society of Nebraska. And the society is actually, as I understand it, the oldest continuous culture group in the state. It was established in 1910. And like any culture groups, we do have an interest in history. And so many of us tend to capture that time in history that was significant in the immigration, typically mid-19th century. But as the as we reached our centenary in 2010, we thought, you know, Wales is still alive and kicking. The history is very much alive and ongoing, as are people of Welsh descent and even new immigrants, people from Wales moving to the United States and making an impact, having influence. And so that's when we came up with the Contemporary Welsh Forum, so that we could really focus on and celebrate some more of the more recent history contributions to the state.
Okay, sounds good. I was wondering about that title, Contemporary, and there you go.
There it is.
I've been talking here with Lori McAllister and Dr. Berwyn Jones. Berwyn will talk about the Welsh settlers in Nebraska. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Lincoln. He is past president of the Great Plains Welsh Heritage Center in Wymore, and his grandparents are from Wymore. Lori McAllister, also very involved, as you can tell, with both Welsh and Scottish heritage events, as well as Office and Program Manager for Lincoln Arts Council. Many hats that you wear, Lori.
It's true. I need more heads.
There you go. Well, both Berwyn and Lori, thank you so much for telling us about the Contemporary Welsh Forum.
Well, thank you for having us.
And for more information about this event or any of the events that you hear about here on Friday Live, go to our webpage at netnebraska.org/radio. The Vesper Concert Series opens its new season in Omaha. Corbin Hirschhorn of KVNO talks to Omaha Symphony violinist Juliet Yoshida about their Baroque Sensations concert this Sunday.
The Vesper Concert Series, based at the Presbyterian Church of the Cross, begins its next season this weekend with Baroque Sensations, a collection of pieces from the composers of the era, Telemann, Vivaldi, and Bach. The concert will feature flute, violins, viola, cello, and harpsichord. Juliet Yoshida, violinist with the Omaha Symphony, has also organized Baroque Sensations.
I organized this concert because I just really wanted to put together a concert that had all Baroque music, and there is no Baroque ensemble in Omaha. So I thought this would be a really good opportunity to just see what level of interest there is in town, in the music-loving community, for Baroque music. So everyone that I chose to play on this concert has an interest in the Baroque period, and because of that, I kind of wanted everyone to choose what they wanted to play. So Alyssa chose her own concerto. I did some digging with Susanna and we agreed on that one. And I just let Brian choose his own solo Bach because that's really a personal choice, I think.
The term classical music refers to many styles and hundreds of years worth of compositions. And the Baroque period started around the year 1600. This was before some of today's popular instruments, like the piano, had even been invented, and contemporary performers consider this in their playing style.
It's kind of interesting. People can be Baroque specialists. For example, in string playing, we use less vibrato. Sometimes people will use period instruments, so there's no chin rest on the violin. The bows are shaped differently. They're shorter, and instead of it arcing downward, it arcs. So it looks more like a bow and arrow, really. We won't be using period instruments, but we will be using those instruments to inform how we use our modern instruments. You're focusing a lot on making musical ideas. Since you don't have vibrato at your disposal, you're more thinking in terms of dynamics and how you use the bow, the speed of the bow. So, like, coordinating dynamic swells and just really focusing on the colors that you can create on the instrument with your bow rather than with your left hand.
Hear Baroque Sensations as part of the Vesper Concert Series this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Presbyterian Church of the Cross. For more information, visit vesperconcerts.org. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hirschhorn.
Next week on Friday Live, we'll talk to Stacey Hanlein, the new executive director of the Vesper Concert Series. I'm Genevieve Randall, and you are listening to NET Radio's Friday Live. The Nebraska Chamber Players open their 2017-18 season tonight at 8 with a second performance on Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m., both of those in the Ron Hall Studio at NET in Lincoln. Founder, artistic director, and flutist Becky van de Bogart is here, and pianist Jack Rinke is here this morning, both to tell us about the concerts. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to see you. So on the program are pieces by some well-known composers. Let's talk about those first. Mozart, Malcolm Arnold, Jacques Ibert. What are the pieces by each of those composers that you're playing?
I think I'll let Jack talk because the Mozart was his idea. So we'll blame him for this one.
Yeah, the Mozart quintet for winds and piano was kind of an experimental work of Mozart. He kind of polished his wind writing in the chamber music genre with that piece, and he transferred it over to the concertos, which were soon followed that period of his output. The piece is great. It's got everything you'd want from a piece by Mozart. It's got the drama, it's got the sparkle, it's got those fabulous, effervescent piano passage work, accentuated by the winds, you know, different couplings and solos and pairs and trios and all together. It's just a really great piece, and I've never played it before. I'm really looking forward to this weekend.
I think effervescent is a perfect word for Mozart.
Absolutely.
Really?
And
if you
don't get the effervescence, you're not getting the right
character.
The right Mozart, yeah.
There was a funny quote that I wrote, that Mozart at one time had said that previous to 452, when parts were pretty optional. That was kind of how I felt about his wind section. Yeah, it's a, you know, if you can, if you don't get him in there, don't worry about it.
Wow.
So much. Because the violin, the viola, and the cello are going to take over because they all double anyway. Right. So this was kind of a pivotal piece in his output, which is funny. And of course, he didn't write for flute because, you know, Mozart and flute didn't really get along very well.
That's what they say. That is the tale that they tell. But I've noticed if you look in history, when he needed the money, he wrote for flute. So.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, there's a letter where he's like, well, I needed some money, so I wrote this concerto.
Oh, I was going to say. But he still wasn't really fond of us in the symphonies and things. I mean, chamber music.
And Becky's saying us because we're both flutists.
All.
Jack, how did you end up at a table with two flutists?
Yeah, we're commiserating over here. Jack's got the piano. He got lots of good stuff out of Mozart.
So, yeah. And Jack, what are some of the other pieces that are highlighting your keyboarding skills?
On this concert,
none. On this concert? You get Mozart, and that's that.
He is a one-trick pony. That is it.
Right. You get the effervescence, and then it's all about the winds after that.
Right.
So let's talk about some of the lesser-known composers featured here. I don't think a lot of people, necessarily, unless you're an organist maybe, know the name Jan Pieterszoon Sveelinck.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Jake Walsh is probably not as well-known a name as well.
Well, Jacob is only maybe 24 years old, mm-hmm. so he's a youth, but... Joyce Besch, our bassoonist, was with her husband, and he was doing a stint at Cornell a couple of years ago. And Jake Walsh was studying oboe and composition at Ithaca College, and Ithaca and Cornell are right there together in Ithaca, New York. And so she ran into the Jake Walsh, and it's for clarinet and bassoon, and it is a great, great duo. And, of course, it's based on cats, so I'm... a little partial anyway. But, I mean, it's compositionally extremely well-written. He did a wonderful job. He's now a doctoral student at Indiana, and the piece was written in 2015. So it's fun to play something that recent.
And about cats, you
and
say?
About kitty cats.
Kittens.
Mango
Aww.
And Tango.
Oh, that's cute.
I know.
So music about cats. I imagine
know.
There's something evoking those little pitter-patter of paws.
I don't know.
These
are pretty wild. These are pretty wild kitty cats, I have to tell you.
So let's talk about this other guy I mentioned,
yep.
Sveelinck.
Sveelinck, right. I mean, actually, the history with Sveelinck is that he was actually the precursor to Bach, you know, 100 years earlier. He was a brilliant improvisational organ player. He was Dutch. And... The variations were one of his most favorite variations based on My Young Life is Ending, which is was a very famous tune in the 1500s. And Ernst Lubin reorchestrated it for quintet, and it's just beautifully done. I mean, he did a very rich setting, and he takes all of the sounds of the quintet and really puts them together at their best. I mean, there are ending chords that just kind of rock your insides. I know, without having all of the pipes and all of the bellows and everything, it still is such a rich tonal texture.
There's a simplicity to it, because I know this piece that you're talking about it.
All flute players.
In its simplicity, it is absolutely elegant and beautiful.
It is an F major scale.
Yeah.
The
right.
entire work is based on a descending F major scale, which... for those of you who know that, I mean, start on F in the piano and just go down with one black key, and to base an entire set of variations on something so wonderfully simple is brilliant.
And it sounds like you've got nice contrast and nice variety there between even those just last two composers that we mentioned there.
And Malcolm Arnold is kooky. I mean, it's all based on sea chanties, so it's all these folk songs from England, and with some rumbas and some tangos and some, you know, funny little variations that he's put in there. And as somebody said, it ends with two champagne bottle cork pops, because the last two notes that we play are brum, brum.
I'm all for the champagne cork popping. Now, Jack, I want to ask you, you are also a composer as well as a keyboardist. Are you working on any compositions for future seasons, or whether it's Nebraska Chamber Players or otherwise?
Well, there's always something a-brewing. It's just a matter of getting my pencil to the paper. I do have a commission coming up from Album Music Lincoln to have a piece on their Christmas concert in December. So that'll be two separate concerts in December. So it'll be a nice exposure. And
cool.
So there's a theme, and they gave me a challenge, and I'm going to
So we're not premiering any of his stuff this year.
He's off the hook with us this year.
But we do have Tristan Fuentes and we do have Christian Ellenwood this year. So.
And how amazing for you guys to have all those composers.
I know.
In the ensemble.
And they're knocking at the door, which is just unbelievable. So... It's wonderful.
Congratulations on starting a brand new season.
Thanks, 21.
Sounds like it's going to be fun. Nebraska Chamber Players open that season tonight at 8 p.m. in the Ron Hall Studio at NET in Lincoln. A second performance on Sunday at 3 p.m. Becky Van de Bogart and Jack Rinke were here to tell us about the season opener. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
You can click on the Friday Live page to link to more information about this and all the events featured on the show. Go to our webpage, netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks for listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio and netnebraska.org, broadcasting from the Mill in downtown Lincoln. I'm Genevieve Randall. The Nebraska Repertory Theater launches its first year-round season September 30th with Abigail 1702 by Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, directed by Nebraska Rep's artistic director Andy Park. Performances will run through October 15th. And joining me to talk about the show are actors Don Richard and Abby Sigworth. Glad to have you both here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Wonderful.
So there's a theme for the Rep's season this year, which is classics reimagined. And this play seems to really fit that. Abigail 1702 is, from what I've studied about it, a sequel to The Crucible. Maybe you guys can fill us in just a little bit more about this particular play.
Yeah, our playwright tried to imagine what happened to Abigail Williams, because in the Arthur Miller play, after a certain courtroom scene, she disappears. It's not really understood what happens to her. So he takes you on a journey that he imagines her next 10 years of her life to have been. And in history, it's a similar story. You don't know much about her life after the Salem Witch Trials either. So it really could have been, in many ways, a true story.
And there's so many playwrights that are experimenting with this whole idea now. If you know that A Doll's House has that new sequel that's on Broadway now, it's getting so much buzz. For the audience coming to see it, you kind of know the situation, the characters, so it gives you an investment even before the play starts. You kind of know, and you latch right in. I was lucky enough to tour Wicked, the musical, for like 7 years, and that was part of that appeal. You had the Wizard of Oz characters, but said, but what if? What if we turned it? So those who might know The Crucible, but even if you know just a little bit about the Salem Witch Trials, here you're watching that situation, but turned on its ear. What could have happened in the next 10 years after that was done? And there's so much about public forgiveness, private forgiveness, so many things that we're kind of looking for in America right now ourselves to figure out what's going on. But here we're talking about it in a context of things you might know or seem familiar.
Yeah.
But taking it a new way, and you're automatically buckled into that roller coaster seat from the minute it starts.
That's interesting because I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. It's like when in literature, when people write fanfic about a certain thing, it just carries out those characters and even ideas that you've wanted to explore more, maybe, perhaps. And that's why people... Which characters are each of you playing? Tell our listeners there.
I'm playing Abigail.
Okay.
So she's the one we follow through her next 10 years. I play... Some of us have to play all the people she meets in those 10 years. So myself and the amazing Virginia Smith from the faculty at the university are playing a semblance of characters that she meets in her adventures as she goes on this road to self-discovery.
So many costumes. So many different
costumes, looks. Great. Just get out there and be ready to...
So many different characters. It's really fun.
And it's so powerful, too. I mean, it's got its fun aspect, but my gosh, there are some scenes that nail you to the floor. We were just talking about it. Mm-hmm. Our rehearsal last night and how that second act has like three of them back to back that in totally different ways.
Gut punches.
Pull your heart, gut punch you, make you breathe so deep. And it's amazing the things he thought of as possibilities
in these people's lives. It really is kind of shocking, the complexity that he is able to take someone you think you know already from this Arthur Miller play and really just break her open in a way that is... really kind of stunning and surprising and reeling. And
I know you don't want to give away too much, but is there maybe just a little sneak peek of some favorite moment or one of those moments you could
I'm
share?
I'm trying to think early in the play.
Well, one thing that's interesting is there is a through line of, for those interested in romantic stories, there is sort of a through line of a love connection. I don't want to tell too much about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many fascinating...
The spirit world is invoked.
The spirit world is invoked. Also, the world they lived in that time period when it comes to disease and illness and how people were treated. It's like a whole history lesson in smallpox in the U.S., how that was being dealt with. And that's such a minor part of the story.
Right.
Sure. But it's in there. It's one of those details that's been in there.
And Roberto has done this before. If anybody knows the Netflix series Riverdale, where he takes the Archie Comics characters and turns them around, it's the same idea he's done. It's the same writer... And often, like he does in that series, he just pulls the rug out from under you where you think you know where you're going, and suddenly a whole new factor is thrown in. So those fans will love it, too.
Very cool. Now, just a little bit about the two of you, because we haven't really talked about your backgrounds too much, and how you came to be involved with this show for Nebraska Rep.
Well, I was lucky enough to meet Andy Park at an audition in Chicago, and he and Brad Buffum, their stage manager, were there, and we had such a great talk and a great time talking about the possibility of coming out here. I had been to Nebraska in the 80s. For 2 years, I toured with the Nebraska Theater Caravan out of Omaha and always loved this state and some of the peaceful places that I found in it. And so a chance to return and see how Lincoln has grown since 1986, which I think was the last time I came.
Lots of changes since you were here with the caravan.
City looks great.
Very good, very good. And how about you?
I had a friend of mine who knew Andy, and Andy was looking for an actor to play Abigail, and he gave my name to Andy, and I put myself on tape, which is basically you set up a camera in your apartment and my cat's walking behind me. Do a couple of monologues. And that's how I ended up here. I think I've driven through Nebraska, and that's about it. It's really exciting to go to the farmer's market every week. I really love being surrounded by good produce.
And we've got lots of that.
Kind people at every corner.
Yeah.
Well, we're so glad to have you here in Nebraska and to be a part of this show.
Yeah, thanks.
I've been talking here with Abby Sigworth and Don Richard. Both are part of Abigail 1702, the opener for this first year-round season for the Nebraska Repertory Theater. Shows are September 30th, October 4th through the 6th, and 11th through the 13th at 7:30 p.m. Also October 1st, 8th, and 15th at 2 p.m. and in the Lead Center's Johnny Carson Theater. And there will definitely be a link on the Friday Live page of our website with more information that you can link to. So, Abby and Don, so great to meet you and talk with both of you.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for being here. Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Robert Goldberg in for Laura Black on Classics by Request. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including engineers James DeShano and Kent Baker, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Genevieve Randall.
Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Milady Coffee House, located in the historic May Brothers Building in Fremont, Nebraska, featuring a living room setting complete with coffee, light lunches, and live music. Nebraska Repertory Theater presenting Abigail 1702 by Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa. 10 years after The Crucible, Abigail Williams' struggles continue with Darkness Returns. On stage at the Lead Center's Johnny Carson Theater, September 30th through October 15th. LeadCenter.org. And the 4th Annual Art Walk Aurora, where downtown Aurora businesses will be hosting local and regional artists Saturday, September 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. More information on Facebook at Art Walk Aurora NE.